All right, John, the fifth chapter. You're visiting with us. We're teaching through the book of John. And the book of John is a wonderful book, as, of course, are all of the books of the Bible. They all have their unique characteristics. And the book of John basically is dealing, with regard to the other gospels, is dealing more with the deity of Christ than the other gospels do. And again, we understand that I suppose every book in the Bible, in the New Testament, points to the deity of Christ in some form or fashion. But that's basically the theme of the book of John. That's his thesis. He is really dealing with that primarily. He wants his readers to see, if they don't see anything else, that Jesus is the Son of God. And that in seeing that, believing that, that they would have life through him. And so he is setting forth different signs with regard to that. We said there are seven signs in the book of John, and that is not as many as the other gospels, but he handpicks these signs that really emphasize the power of Christ. And we've seen three of those signs so far. We saw that Jesus has power over substance when he changed water into wine. And again, no man could do that but one who is divine. And we've seen the last two signs had to do with him having power over illness, healing the nobleman's son of whatever illness he had that led to the fever that he was about to die from. And Jesus, from 20 miles away, just spoke the word and he was healed. And in John chapter 5, as we've been studying, we see that he heals a crippled man, a man who was crippled for 38 years. And, of course, we went over the story of the pool of Bethesda and how they would lay people there. And the first one into the water, the tradition was, would be healed. And, of course, there wasn't any real power in that water, as we talked about before. But Jesus had real power. He is, again, the Son of God, so he could heal. And he immediately heals this crippled man. And we see that all of that happened at really a strategic time, that he did that on the Sabbath. I pointed out last week that Jesus did that on purpose. And all you have to do is get out of concordance and you'll see that how many times Jesus healed individuals on the Sabbath, and you start to figure out he kind of does that on purpose. And the reason for that is he knows the misunderstanding of the Jewish leaders and how that they're perverting the Sabbath. And so he knows that that would anger them, and he'd have a chance not only to teach the people but kind of scold them at the same time. And so we see that going on here in John chapter 5. So down at verse 14, it says, after Jesus found him, that is the man that he healed, in the temple, and said to him, see that you are well, sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. And that is about the place we left off last week. If I remember correctly, we were just getting into the point that certainly sin is dangerous, and we should all abstain from sin. And when we think about sin, the first danger of sin, of course, is the separation from God. Over in Isaiah chapter 59, you might want to look at that familiar passage in Isaiah chapter 59, and at verse 1, I think most of us are familiar with this. Isaiah, the great prophet, writes, behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, or his ear dull that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God. And, of course, that is something that happens whenever a person gets involved in sin. And your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear. So it even interrupts our prayer life. And so the point of it is, sin then, that is the first danger with regard to sin. That is the primary danger of sin. The reason why we ought to make up in our mind here tonight that we're going to stay as far away from sin as we possibly can. And speaking of something that you read about in almost every book of the Bible, in fact, every book of the New Testament, is in some form or fashion encouraging us to stay away from sin. Sin, of course, again, separates us from God. Remember 1 John chapter 2, that John, after writing all that he did in chapter 1 about the fellowship that we can have with God, a very positive and uplifting chapter in the Bible when you start to think about what we have with God if we walk in the light And he tells us in chapter 2, I've written these things unto you that you sin not. And so that was the primary purpose of John going through all that he did. In John chapter 1, he's trying to get Christians to understand you need not to sin. You do everything you can to stay away from sin. Now, we all fall short, of course, and he even acknowledges that. If any man sin, he has an advocate with the Father, the man Jesus Christ. But his point is, we want you to do your very best not to sin. And that should be all of us. That should be the attitude that we have. And so that's the first danger and the primary danger with sin. But it does carry some physical consequences sometimes. And Jesus seems to point out here in John 5 at verse 14 that this man who was crippled, that perhaps at least, this isn't necessarily implied, but it is implied, that that perhaps sin somehow in some way contributed to his crippleness. And again, a lot of scholars believe that's what Jesus is saying there. It's not an absolute certain. But one thing that is certain is sometimes sin leads to some physical problems. Look over at Romans chapter 1, and here's a familiar passage, I think, and a classic passage that teaches this lesson. And as you turn over there, I think I said last week as we were closing, that even if Jesus is indicating that, he's not indicating that every illness that a person has is directly related to sin. That's not really the point. In fact, he teaches against that in John chapter 9. He just would be making the point that it is possible, if he's making this connection with this man, then clearly it is possible for sin to have a negative effect upon you from a physical standpoint. Romans chapter 1 is the passage I'm getting to here. At verse 24, therefore, God gave them up to the lust of their own hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worship and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. Now, verse 27 lets us know what he's talking about there. Verse 27 says, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. Now, you see the last part of that. Receiving in themselves the due penalty of their error. That's talking about some kind of physical problem, disease, or illness that they had as a result of their homosexual activity. It's passages like this. Well, some people would say that a disease like AIDS is, you know, when that was really at its height, and I don't know that it's died down much now. You don't hear much about it anymore. But people say, well, that's God directly punishing individuals for homosexuality. And I've never really subscribed to that position, that it was God directly doing that. But there was some here in Romans chapter 1, there was some kind of physical disease or problem that these individuals were having. It didn't have to be AIDS. It could have been some other sexually transmitted disease or whatever. But the point of it is, sometimes when you sin and get involved in sin, like fornication, there's going to be some physical consequences to that. AIDS, by the way, is a disease that comes about because of sin, primarily. The only thing I can think of that an individual could have AIDS without sin being involved would be a blood transfusion. Or sometimes infants, sometimes babies are born with that because their mothers have HIV or whatever. Now, I'm no doctor, and I haven't researched that completely, but that's all I can think of. Maybe you can think of something else. But I can only think of those two ways that a person can contract AIDS or HIV without sinning. Primarily, it comes from what? From fornication and from drug use. It's why how many of you have never feared at all having AIDS? In fact, I can tell you right now how we could eradicate that disease from the face of this earth. Everybody stop fornicating, no more drug use, and it would disappear. Because it is a disease that comes because of one's behavior. Now, again, there have been cases where that hasn't been the case because the blood transfusion, even though they have so many safeguards now that you don't hear about that very often, or infants, someone, a baby being born and having it because of the mother. But other than that, so that just plays into all of this. That, and the point of it all simply is there's a good reason why we should do everything we can as Christians not to sin. First and foremost, because we love God. And we know it will destroy our soul. But also because it could have some terrible negative influences or impacts upon us from a physical standpoint. And not just disease. I mean, you think of just from a physical standpoint, all the problems that sin has caused. You think there ever been any sadness, sorrow in this world caused by gambling? Yes. Even when it comes down to fornication or, in this case, adultery, how many families have been destroyed because of that? Even if there aren't any bodily problems that come from fornication, sometimes families are ruined. Any lives ruined by drunkenness? Doctors would tell you that smoking, it leads to all kinds of physical problems and can be traced to just about any problem that an individual has. If someone is a chain smoker or whatever, just all kind of things. And so the point of it is, we need as Christians, we need to stay as far away from sin as we possibly can. And for the primary reason of pleasing God, but also because you could live a better life. Turn back over to John chapter 5. We'll move on from this. But I tell you, there's a fellow I know who actually is a Christian. He was converted when I was in Louisville. And he was just a few years older than I am. And I'm telling you, as I studied with him and we eventually baptized him, I would have told you he was 15 years older than me. And because he looked so bad. And the reason he looked so bad is because he lived such a hard life. In fact, I just came back from California, but here last month or whatever, from seeing my family. And I'm telling you, when I saw my mother for the first time I had seen her in 11 years, and she looked like she was dying. it was pitiful to me. And now my brother and my relative said, you know, she actually looks pretty good right now. So she was improving. But I hadn't seen her in so long that it looked like, I mean, she just looked terrible. And truth be told, my mother drank all her life, and she smoked all her life, and lived a hard life. And here it is. My aunt, who was visiting there, she's 4 years older than my mother, and she was always the religious part of the family. And she looked great. And isn't that something? And same family, same genes or whatever. And she's 4 years older, and she's 78, looked great. And so it's just what sin does. It ruins, it wrecks your life physically. Spiritually, we know, but even physically, it can. So, you got any inclination at all to dabble in any kind of sin, you'd be best to stay away from that. All right, let's get into the text and cover some ground here with what Jesus says here. Verse 15, he says, "The man went away then, and he told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him." And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. And it's just amazing to me, as we pointed out last week, that these Jews they just have tunnel vision here. They're all upset because Jesus did something that they thought he shouldn't do on the Sabbath. They're not even thinking about the mercy involved. They're not even thinking about, here's a man who hasn't walked in 38 years, and now he is healed. He can live a normal life. What a blessing. What a happy, a joyous occasion. All they can think of, when did it happen? Oh, he did it on the Sabbath. And so that's all they can think. They're not even thinking about the fact that a real, genuine miracle has taken place. Now, I don't know about you, but that's the thing that would flood my mind. That, I mean, everybody knows he couldn't walk. He wasn't a plant or anything like that. He was at this pool of Bethesda. Everybody knew that he couldn't walk, and yet now here he is walking around. A great miracle has taken place. If that was somebody that you knew, wouldn't you have some questions about that? Would the first thing come to your mind, what day of the week was it when he was healed? And it just shows the lack of love that these Jewish leaders had. That they weren't thinking about anything but their own little interpretation of the law, which, by the way, was incorrect. No violation of the Sabbath has taken place here at all. But that's all they could think about. And so this man goes and he tells them now, remember at first he didn't know who healed him, who it was, but now he knows. And he goes back and he tells the Jews. And so this leads to a conversation between Jesus and these Jews. We don't have too many of their words here, but we can tell from what Jesus said about what they were doing. They are really attacking Jesus because he healed on the Sabbath. And so we begin to deal with that then. Again, they were persecuting Jesus, it says. And no physical persecution there, obviously. It was more in word than anything else. But they're persecuting Jesus. Maybe trying to ruin his reputation. And spreading lies about him and how he's a Sabbath day breaker and all of that. But they're persecuting him because what he did these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working unto now, and I am working." And what a brilliant response from Jesus. And you grow to expect that from Jesus, of course. The greatest teacher, the greatest preacher, whatever, that has ever lived. He's the Son of God. But he right away would put them on the defensive in saying that. "My Father worketh unto now." I mean, you stop. What he's basically saying to the Jews is, all right, if you're going to try to get all technical about this thing and you're misapplying the law anyway, but your idea is you can't do anything on the Sabbath. Well, what about God? Was he a Sabbath day breaker? Did God do anything on the Sabbath? Every Sabbath. You think God, you know, the Bible says that God rested on the seventh day, talking about his creation. But what did he rest from? Everything? How many of you think that every Sabbath God's providential care took a break? Yeah, that's right. That's right. You think, yes. I mean, just think of all the things. You think any babies are born on the Sabbath? Isn't it God who creates life? You think his love and his mercy, you think they cease on the seventh day? No, God is constantly at work. Even, in fact, you go back to Genesis chapter 1, when he created the heavens and the earth and all of that, he rested from his work of creation. But guess what he was doing on the Sabbath day? He was keeping all those stars, the sun and the moon, in heaven. He was holding everything together. By the way, through his creative agent, Jesus. But the point of it is, God, everybody, the Jews would readily admit, God wasn't completely idle on the Sabbath. And so Jesus brings this out. "My Father works unto now, and I work." You want to accuse me? You better start accusing God. And again, right away, that would put them on the defensive. But really, again, they have tunnel vision. It seems like throughout their dealings with Jesus, they don't give his arguments a whole lot of thought. They should. I mean, this is a powerful thing that Jesus just said. But now all they can do is, he says, "My Father worketh unto now." Now, right away, that would take their mind off of the Sabbath, all right. Because now all of a sudden, the Sabbath is secondary. He has just committed a far worse sin. He's committed blasphemy because he called God his Father. And so I forget about the Sabbath now. You know, you could just see them saying, "What'd you say? You call God your Father?" And they would immediately connect the dots there. I've said to you, I think before, I'm sure I have in many sermons and I have through the years, emphasized that whenever Jesus used the word Father, and by the way, again, Jesus, he never did anything on accident. Whether it's healing on the Sabbath, he knew exactly what he was doing and why he was doing it at that particular time. And it's the same thing with his words. Jesus didn't speak out of words. When he called God his Father, he did it on purpose and for a reason. First of all, it was true, obviously, but it was more than that. He knew how the Jews would feel about that. He knew what it would mean to them. He knew that they would understand what it meant. And it meant exactly what they thought it meant. Every time Jesus called God Father, it was an affirmative of his deity. He was claiming equality with God. And you keep that in mind. Whenever Jesus refers to God as Father, he's claiming equality with God. That is by necessity demanding that he's the same kind of being as God, that they are equal. Not in regard to authority. We see even throughout this chapter that he has submitted himself to the will of the Father. And so we understand that. Remember in last chapter, what did he say his meat was? To do his Father's will. So Jesus knew exactly who he was and what position he was in with regard to God's scheme of redemption. He was the Redeemer. He came to be the suffering Savior. He was under the authority of the Father. There was no mistaking that. And he understood that. But he also understood that he and his Father were one. And throughout this chapter and other chapters in the book of John, that's the main emphasis, the oneness of him and his Father. And that would just tear the Jews up. They didn't relate to that at all. They didn't think there was anyone who was one with God. But now they're being confronted by someone who is actually the Son of God, who is actually God manifested in the flesh. And again, right when Jesus makes this argument at verse 17, makes this statement, they would catch it right away. Verse 18 says, and this was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his Father, making himself equal with God. And that's exactly right. That's what he was doing. And he does it. Look over at John chapter 10 just for a minute. In John the 10th chapter, we see how quickly the Jews picked up on that kind of language. And always they would persecute him. They wanted to kill him whenever he got into that. In verse 29, we don't have to read this whole context here, but in John 10, let's start about verse 29, I think. He says, my Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. So he uses that repeatedly. Then he even says, I and the Father are one. The Jews picked up stones again to stone him. Jesus answered them, I have shown you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you going to stone me? The Jews answered him, it is not for good work that we are going to stone you, but for blasphemy. Because you, being a man, make yourself God. When did he make himself God? How did he make himself God? By saying he's one with the Father. And in fact, every time he's referring, again, every time he's referring to God as his Father, he's making that point. They wanted to kill him. And so he understands over here in John chapter 5, he knows that's exactly how they're responding to this. And one of the things that we find is that Jesus doesn't correct them. Why? Because it's true. That's exactly right. Because they weren't wrong. They were wrong about a whole lot of things, but they weren't wrong about that. Jesus was making himself equal with God. And I have emphasized before and will continue to emphasize in teaching and preaching, that's a part of your salvation. Don't leave it nice saying, Don may have been right about that. No, the Bible's right about that. And that's a part of your good confession. If you deny the deity of Christ, you're not going to heaven. Because that's to deny Jesus himself. He is God. Always has been, always will be. He's God manifested in the flesh. He's one with the Father. He's equal with the Father. Over and over again, that's the emphasis of the Bible. And we'll see as we go down through the rest of this, Jesus is emphasizing that quickly, one time after another in different ways. That sometimes when we read this as Westerners and we may not being as familiar as the Jews were even with their old law, we may read some of this and not catch it, but there's a lot of things that Jesus says in here that right away the Jews would think, he's claiming to be deity. He's claiming to be God and want to get those stones out and kill him. And again, Jesus is not doing it on accident. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's affirming over and over again he's God, because that's who he is. And we better believe that's who he is, and that better be our testimony with regard to Jesus. He is God manifest in the flesh. Yes. Yes, yes. I read not too long ago, I can't remember why I read it, it was a Jewish website, and the fellow there was, he was very strong in his denial that Jesus, what I was reading, I can't remember all the details of it, but he was listing why Jesus cannot be the Messiah. And as I've said before, some of you have made trips to Jerusalem and things, and you probably have seen. I when I went there, I saw, looking out of the hotel window, you could see down into the city of Jerusalem, where there it would be at a particular time. There, all you see is a sea. All I saw was a sea of black. I've heard sometimes they're all dressed in red. What I saw was a sea of black, and they were all by the Wailing Wall, and they were praying. Guess what they were praying for? They were praying for the Messiah to come, not realizing that he came nearly 2,000 years ago. And that's a sad situation. But they're confused about that, and it's nothing new. They're confused. They couldn't see it here in John chapter 5. They just can't see it. And we'll see that as we go through the... Yes, Sam. Oh, they do. I didn't know that. Yeah. How about that? So people, I mean, it's what people can get into their mind is can really take them far off of the truth, and again, we'll see that as we go through this. All right, let's get back to the text. Then he claims equality with God, verse 19. So Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say unto you, the Son of Man can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise." Now, you stop and think about that. You may not see that right away, but that's a strong affirmation of the deity of Christ. You better believe the Jews would hear that, and they would immediately think he's committing blasphemy. Now, you read that again. Yeah, "Truly I say unto you, the Son," right away, that's blasphemy to them, "can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing." So wait a minute. But you know what they would say? You mean to tell me you're doing the works of God? That's exactly what he's affirming. The Son does whatever the Father does. Now, we understand from the teaching of the New Testament, that's just an affirmative that Jesus, again, is the active agent of God. But if he can do the works of God, what does that make him? That makes him divine. And I made mention of it just in passing, but even in the creation of the world, remember over in Hebrews chapter 1, turn over there and listen to what the Hebrew writer says. Hebrews chapter 1 and at verse 2 and 3, it says, "But in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he created the world." I mean, that's powerful stuff. That's Jesus. That's who we serve. That's our master. That God created the world, the heavens and the earth, everything you read about in the book of Genesis. Jesus was the active agent of God. Jesus was actually doing the creating. God, through him, the Hebrew writer said, created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God in the exact imprint of his nature. And there's just all kind of passages that point to that. But that goes right along with what Jesus says now here in John chapter 5, when he claims that he does the work of the Father. Whatever you see the Father doing, he says, "For whatever the Father does, that the Son does also. I mean, that has deity written all over it. And again, would be very upsetting to the Jews. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing. And greater works than these will he show him, so that you may marvel. That's Jesus' way of saying, I'm just getting started. You think this is something? You haven't seen anything yet. And Jesus is about, through his personal ministry, he does far greater things than simply healing a crippled man. And he's about to talk about some of those things. But Jesus being God, of course, he knows exactly what's coming and what he's going to be doing during his personal ministry. But this is healing a man who's crippled. I mean, to us, we think, man, that is something else. You've never seen anything like that. But he's saying, no, that's nothing. I'm just getting started with this. And he's going to do everything from raise the dead to walk on water and to do all kinds of things. And not to mention even the powerful thing he does just in regard to the scheme of redemption. But he's going to do far greater works himself, and through his apostles do far greater work than that. And so he says, for the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, and so also the Son gives life to whom he will. Now, what do you think is greater, healing a man who's crippled for 38 years or giving life to a man who's dead, raising the dead? What's greater? Certainly the giving of life. And you know who the giving of life is reserved for? Who can give life? God. And nobody but God. Look over at the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 39. Deuteronomy chapter 39, you got to remember that these are things that the Jews would just take for granted. That this is common knowledge to the Jew. The Jew would automatically think nobody can give life but God, huh? I said 32, didn't I? 32:39. Look at verse 39. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. Typical language. God uses that kind of language all the time. But now watch. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal. That part right there. I kill and I make alive. The point of it is, the Jews knew that about God. God makes alive. God brings to life. He's the giver of life. We're not reading it now, but you might remember over in 2 Kings when you remember the commander Naaman. We're all familiar with him being cleansed of his leprosy and all of that. And you remember when the king of Syria first sent, he heard about the prophet there who could heal his commander. So he sent a letter to the king of Israel saying, you know, you need to heal him. And the king got that, and he said, he thought it was a setup. Like, oh, he's trying to get me to do something he knows I can't do. And the statement that he made is that only God gives life. And so he thought it was just being trapped. He wasn't being entrapped at all. He didn't realize that he had a prophet right there that could heal this commander. But he made that statement. God gives life. That was ingrained in the mind of the Jews. God is the one that gives life. And now here's Jesus in John chapter 5 saying he has the power to do what? To give life. And the Jews would think immediately, who does he think he he's God? And that's exactly who he knew he was. And so, again, throughout all of this, we're seeing Jesus affirming his in almost every verse of this, he's affirming his deity. Watch as we go on just a little bit further, the very next verse, the Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son. Use the word Father and the word Son. Oh, that's blasphemy. But now he says, and they know he's talking about himself, he's the Son, and he's saying, now the Father has given me all judgment as something else. You get out and you go back through the New Old Testament and you see who the Jews believe was the judge of all the earth. That was Yahweh. He's the judge. In fact, there's very few indications at all that the Jews ever thought the Messiah would be in a role of judgment other than helping them escape the yoke that they were under with regard to their enemies, in this case, the Romans. But they didn't view in their thought of things as the Messiah being the judge in the day of judgment. There's some talk about that in the book of Enoch over and over again, and the Jews took that seriously. They believed in that book, but they didn't think that was in the scriptures. And so here's Jesus saying, I'm going to be the judge, which is very, very ironic. In a minute, go ahead to Matt. Yes. 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 Yes, I believe there's different interpretations of that, but that's a very strong one that a lot of people conclude that he's making that point. But before the bell rings, I mean, you just think about him, Jesus saying, I mean, you just keep all of this in your mind. Jesus saying, the Father has given me all judgment. I mean, the Jews have approached Jesus and they're almost putting him on trial, questioning him. And who gives you the right to heal on the Sabbath and all that? And Jesus basically is saying, listen, who are you to tell me? You don't realize. You're trying to put me on trial. You're talking to the judge. I'm the judge in this thing. He's their judge. And the Father has given him all judgment. And it just, all of that is very ironic, really, even with this Sabbath day business. Accusing Jesus of breaking the Sabbath. Who do they think created the Sabbath? It was God. But what they're figuring out is, or they may not believe it, but what Jesus is telling them is, I'm God. I'm deity. They're all upset because he's breaking the Sabbath. The Sabbath was his law. And so it's all, again, very ironic from that standpoint. But again, verse 22, when he claims to be the judge, that would be another, almost every verse, he's affirming his deity. And the Jews would know it. And it's exactly right. All right, we'll pick up in the rest of chapter 5 next week. Appreciate your attention.